Senate Judiciary and Public Safety Committee will start again after lunch break. For the record, this is February, April 15th. Senator Han, Senate File 160.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I appreciate the opportunity to be here this afternoon now, I guess. And I did want to make a quick comment about I was here when you were dealing with Senator Daley's bill. And the bill I have also deals with obesity and limits on liability. But I did want to point out that as this is not the first time I've been before the Judiciary Committee, so I would expect I will not be subjected to the same form of hazing that the committee imposed on Senator Daley. So just, I'm
Sir
just
Han,
hopeful.
It's been a long time since you've been before the committee, hasn't it?
I do have, Mr. Chairman, a couple of author's amendments that I believe you may have in your materials. If not, I think Senate Counsel has them. I'd like to offer those as author's amendments.
The author's amendment has been, they're being passed out. Senator Han.
And Mr. Chairman and members, these amendments are ones
what's,
that...
What's the number of your author's amendment?
The amendments I have are... Actually, these are probably not, I probably don't have the right numbers because these are the ones that were offered in the other body. So one has to do with the definition of food and the other has to do with inserting the language and willful. One is rather short and one is a little bit longer.
Senator Han, are you looking at the A4 amendment?
Are they together as one amendment, Mr. Chairman?
No.
Mr. Chairman, it's the A3 and the A4 amendments, but let's take them in order. And if I could,
Senator Han offers the A3 amendment as an author's amendment.
And Mr. Chairman and members, again, this is a definition of food. This is an amendment that was put on this bill in the other body, so my intent is just to try to make the language of the bill conform.
Pardon me, Senator Han. I recognize you as a member of the committee by moving the amendment. We need someone else to move it. Senator Newman, would you move the author's amendment, the A3 amendment, on behalf of the chief author?
I so move, Mr. Chairman.
The amendment's before us. Senator Han.
And members, again, just language that puts the bill in conformance with the bill as it exists in the other body with the hopes that if it were to pass, we could avoid conferencing the bill.
It appears as though this is a definition that you're claiming under the U.S. Code. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Senator Han.
And then, Mr. Chairman and members, I'd like to offer again as an author's amendment the A4 amendment.
Senator Newman moves the A4 amendment.
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Senator Han.
Mr. Chairman, another amendment to also conform to the language as it exists in the companion bill in the other body. And if there are no questions at this point on the amendments, I would like to just briefly review the bill. This has been a bill that has been around in the legislature for a number of years. I think 5 or 6 years ago, I carried the companion bill in the Senate. At that time, we did pass it through two committees in the Senate. Did not make it through the final floor process in the Senate. This does have bipartisan support. And it is a very narrowly drawn limiting of liability. And the intent is to underscore that individuals are responsible for their own actions, particularly when it comes to the choices of food that they eat. There are legitimate lawsuits involving food that have to do with tainting or mislabeling or dishonest or fraudulent behavior. This bill does nothing to change the allowable actions under those conditions. But very simply put, what this bill says, if you eat too many cheeseburgers, and by the way, I just had one, but if you eat too many and you gain weight, that's your responsibility and no one else's, and we shouldn't permit the lawsuit based on that claim. What this bill does is offer some protection to retailers, processors, ultimately the producers, our farmers, who may be subject to a lawsuit or a group action that would try to attach the concern about obesity that we have currently in our society to reach out to people that have no liability, in my opinion, and I think this bill will try to make that clear. This really is about trying to establish that people have responsibility for the choices that they make. I believe at the last count I looked at, 23 other states have similar legislation passed. This is not something that was just made up and brought out of nowhere. There have been instances in other states. Back in 2003, I think, was the first claim in New York, where several young people brought a claim against McDonald's on the basis of weight gain and attaching liability to McDonald's Corporation for their weight gain. There have been other lawsuits involving Kellogg's, Burger King, Kentucky Fried Chicken, Wendy's. These were all settled out of court eventually, but there clearly are costs when lawsuits are brought, even if they result in settlements that don't go to trial. Last summer, there were lawsuits filed against McDonald's in California based on Happy Meals, and there may be others. There has been recently, I think last year, a judgment won in Brazil against McDonald's by an individual who claimed and was successful in pressing the claim that his obesity was due to, McDonald's had liability for that. There have been no settlements, as I said, of claims or cases brought in the United States, although they do cost, I believe, cost us indirectly through increasing prices at the checkout counter or at the restaurant. And there have been no lawsuits brought in Minnesota. I am aware of Public Health Advocacy Institute held a conference in Boston. One of the seminars was entitled Legal Approaches to the Obesity Epidemic. So clearly there is being contemplated action against food manufacturers, retailers, and producers on the basis of obesity claims as it relates to food. This, again, is not really about obesity. We recognize that we do have a problem with obesity. This is not an attempt to solve that problem, but simply to limit the exposure that people who do not have that liability, in my opinion, from being charged with and having to pay costs associated with defending the claim that they should not be held liable. There is I believe in your packet of material, a list of past supporters. This is when the bill was previously brought to the legislature. It has a large number of mostly agriculture and food retailer and producer organizations that support it. To my knowledge, there is only one organization that opposes the bill. I think the trial lawyer groups oppose it. There's also a map that shows where these laws currently exist. And so, ultimately, I think that the purpose of the legislation, again, is to ensure personal responsibility and to recognize that this is the venue of a food court and not a court of law. And that while we all are concerned with obesity, in fact, if we do not do this, we run the risk of fattening the wallets of the trial lawyers who go after corporations for purposes of claims of this nature. So I would appreciate your support. And I do not have any witnesses to testify on behalf of the bill. As I said, it has been heard in committees in the Senate in the past and would appreciate your consideration. I believe there are at least one person that may want to testify on the bill.
Any questions of the author, Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Hand, line 1.22, group of individuals. Is this that term, is that, are we talking about class action lawsuits when we have that in statute? Is that something of concern at all, or is that why that is in there? And my other question would be is, of course, this does not cover getting sick or injured while consuming not food.
Senator Hand.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Ingebrigtsen, yes, the term group of individuals does refer to the potential action of a class action lawsuit. There have been in other cases liability issues brought on behalf of a class, and this would want to include that as a limit against that action as well. And as I said earlier, this does not bar any claim that is a result of a tainted food product, a product that has been mislabeled, or other forms of negligence with respect to food or food handling. It is simply saying that we will not accept a lawsuit based on the claim that it is the fault of a manufacturer, supplier, producer for obesity.
Any other questions? Senator Latz.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hand, what if the food product is marketed in such a way that suggests it's some sort of healthy food? Would this bill protect the company from liability as a result of that?
Senator Hand.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Latz, if a food product were marketed in a false and misleading way, I don't believe that this legislation would affect that. The prohibitions that exist against labeling food or trying to market it under false colors, that would certainly, that this legislation would not prohibit a lawsuit based on that fact. If a product has been deemed to be something and it isn't, this legislation would not extend to that.
Senator Latz.
So if you had a clearly misleading marketing campaign, you're saying maybe you could still sue them because the marketing itself was misleading. But what if the effect of that misleading marketing campaign is that someone decides they can eat a lot more of this stuff, cheeseburgers, for example? I'm looking in particular at subdivision 4 on page 2 of the bill. It looks like lines 2.6 to 9, would have an impact. It's not much of a limit on the broad immunity that is granted in subdivision 3. It says the violation has to be knowing, willful, and reckless.
Senator Hamm.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz, I think Subdivision 4 is trying to outline, to your point, what that this legislation would not apply to a claim of weight gain or obesity that's based on one of these other violations of existing law. So if a violation of advertising or labeling were a part of the case, this would not limit the ability of someone to bring an action based on that.
Senator Latz.
Just a kind of a drafting question, then maybe Ms. Pontius, but on line 2.8, it intended that, unless I'm misreading the amendment wrong, it should be knowing, willful, and reckless, or reckless. What's the intent there?
Senator Hand.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Latz, and certainly Senate Counsel, if you wanted to comment, but the amendment that we adopted that was put on the bill in the other House changes it to include the word reckless in the list. I'm presuming that is a term that has a legal meaning, and that's why it was inserted into the language. But I can't tell you what the definition of that would mean in a legal matter.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman,
we'll have counsel,
Senator Latz, I mean, it does require that it be knowing, willful, and reckless. Now, it's hard. I think in most cases, if it's knowing or willful, it's probably going to be reckless, but it does have all three in there.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Latz.
I think my point, especially with that clarification, is that exception to the immunity is so narrow as to be almost unhelpful. hardly an exception at all. But let's, I guess, that's a comment, I guess, not a question.
All right. All right. Any further discussion? Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to speak for or against the bill? Welcome to the committee. Would you identify
yourself?
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. I'm getting a workout today. Mr. Chairman, Joel Carlson, I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice, and we do have concerns about the bill, and our concern is not that we're here to protect a case for weight gain. The first case of one of only three that I'm aware of was filed in November of 2002, and I think no one has done more to promote the idea of obesity lawsuits than the proponents of this bill. Not a single case has ever been filed in Minnesota and in most states. And our concern is that while there are no cases that have been filed, this really does ignore issues like we just got done with Senator Daley's bill, the national epidemic of obesity. The American Medical Association says obesity causes over 400,000 deaths per year in the United States. The Center for Disease Control says 60% of us are overweight, and I'm probably in that category. 24% are obesely overweight. This legislation tends to ignore the problem that we have on childhood obesity, and it says that this is all about personal responsibility. You know, we just got done with a bill where we talked a lot about parents, schools, and others that all play a role in children's health. And to say that children are going to be responsible for what they consume is just not right. It's not personal responsibility just for children. We also have the government that has taken a significant role in what we consume. We have food labeling requirements. We have packaging. We need to know the caloric intake. To say it's personal responsibility ignores the active effort of the government to protect us from what we eat and how it's packaged and marketed. I just think it's unfair to say this is about personal responsibility when we know that there are so many consumers that are not fully informed about what they're consuming. But more importantly to the bill, weight gain cases are not allowed in Minnesota because Minnesota already requires personal responsibility in any litigation in Minnesota. Minnesota under 604 requires the assumption of risk of our own conduct. And we don't believe that these cases would be meritorious in Minnesota just for that fact alone. There are also significant proof issues related to the many causes of obesity, lack of exercise, the lifestyle, our food intake, our genetic disposition. To suggest that our weight gain is simply from what we eat is such a high hurdle that no one would ever successfully bring a case, and no one ever has successfully brought a case in Minnesota. In fact, a lawyer bringing such a claim in Minnesota that would be legally insufficient would subject themselves to sanction under 549.211. And this obviously is not happening in Minnesota, not just on these kinds of cases, but on all civil cases. As you heard during the judiciary budget discussion, civil case filings in Minnesota are down over 40% in the last 10 years. There's no rash of civil litigation in Minnesota. There's no litigation crisis, and certainly no litigation as it relates to weight gain or obesity lawsuits. I have a couple concerns about the bill and a couple points that I want to address. One I'll go back to right now while I'm thinking of it. The issue of groups of individuals and class action cases, you need to know that in one case, in New York, where they attempted to certify the case as a class action, it was flatly rejected by the court. And what they said is that a class action in this setting over someone's personal health and personal health and activity would never be certified as a class because you do not have a universe of people that are similarly situated. So you would never have a class action in Minnesota, and we suggest elsewhere just based on that fact alone because it's not ripe for class certification. Senator Hahn has mentioned today and in the past that there is a conference and that lawyers are, schooling up to have these cases. And what he's talking about is a conference that was held in 2003 by the Public Health Advocacy Institute, and it was entitled Legal Approaches to the Obesity Epidemic. And what they discussed was legislation, maybe like we heard earlier today. They discussed regulation and food labeling and caloric content requirements, and they talked about litigation as it relates to the content of food product. And it was not about a seminar to learn how to file lawsuits against the fast food industry. To the bill, Mr. Chairman and members, you need to know that this bill applies to any food that's consumed more than once. The exception on line 1.12 and 1.23 means that that if you consume it more than once, that this bill applies, because the description of the bill only excludes a single instance of food consumption. And when you read the bill, you will see for the first time, I believe, in Minnesota's history, the law would be providing immunity to a manufacturer for their civil liability based on liability for weight gain, or more importantly, a health condition related to weight gain. If this bill was simply about, I ate too many cheeseburgers and I got fat and I shouldn't bring a case, I think we all agree that should not be a case. It isn't. It never has been. What this talks about is the health conditions that we may have, and I would submit to you that anybody who consumes something more than once who has an adverse health event would find this bill used as a leverage against them to try and assert immunity. The protections on the back, Mr. Chair and members, are of little help for someone who actually did consume food that did cause an adverse health condition, because the protections, number one, are extremely difficult because it requires a material violation. Material in this setting, we believe, would mean that the violation would have to have taken place in a way that caused you the injury. Not that they mislabeled it, not that it misbranded it, but that that misbranding had to be material to your injury. And you talked a little bit about the problems with 2.8. Knowledge is extremely difficult to prove. It doesn't even say known or should have known, as most laws do that we have, where we talk about that standard. But to say that to escape this immunity to manufacturers for a violation that they know about, they willfully did, and they did it recklessly, is an absolute a bar to any recovery as we read the language. Immunity is really granted to the government. It isn't something that we grant to individual businesses or groups of businesses, and this is the first time where we would be granting that to a whole industry without having any idea of what the potential consequences are. Senator Hahn also mentioned that there were some cases about what's in our food. Pertinent case that I'm aware of was actually brought by the American Heart Association, and who was just here not too long ago, and they did reach a settlement with McDonald's and over McDonald's trans fat in their French fries. McDonald's said they're going to take it out of their French fries. They told the consumers they were going to do that, and they didn't. And the American Heart Association brought action against them to take that out of their food. They agreed that they had promised to do it and didn't. They paid a $7 million settlement to the American Heart Association for a public education campaign about obesity. So that's the extent of food litigation that we are aware of. And of the states that have adopted this, Mr. Chair and Member, you need to know this is a model bill that's pushed by the American Legislative Exchange Council. It has been defeated in a number of states as well, including Minnesota. I think we've been at this now since 2000 and for. It is just being pushed nationally, and we think it serves to undermine our right to our confidence in our civil justice system, because it tells people that lawyers are actually bringing cases like this that don't have merit. We know that's not the case, and we think that it serves to undermine our confidence in the judiciary. We also think that it's constitutionally infirm, because it, should there be such a case, we are denying someone a right to a remedy under the bill if these circumstances were present. The only time you need immunity is when you have done something wrong that causes an injury to somebody, and this is the government saying we're not going to hold you accountable for that. That's the only time you would need a bill like this, and we suggest that that just simply goes too far. So we're not here to protect weight gain cases. We're here to say this is not what that bill's about. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Happy to answer questions.
Senator Thompson.
You know, Mr. Chairman, there occasionally are pieces of legislation that really enlighten the difference between the intelligentsia and the normal people on the ground. This is one of them. This bill is very simple, and it's very common sense. It relates everything to weight gain, health problems associated with weight gain due to long-term consumption of food that makes you fat. The question is simply whether we're going to rely upon the government to give us the proper calorie intake for the day and what individual articles of food contain for calorie intake and the like. That's what this is about. Frankly, Subdivision 4 could have been omitted. It wouldn't have even had to have been there, but I suspect it was put in to acknowledge the fact that we're not attempting to rewrite other kinds of legislation pertaining to problems with specific food. The fact of the matter is, you know when the whole smoking thing happened? I had a debate with a buddy of mine that's a physician, and he, of course, was concerned about the smokers that came to see him, and I said, you know what's going to be next? We're going to be telling people that, that you know, they have to eat certain kinds of food and not eat certain kinds of other food, or they're going to get fat. He laughed at me. Oh, that's a different thing. No, it's not, Mr. Chairman and members. Once the government gets in the business of saying, you are too stupid to look in the mirror and understand you're overweight, or you can't read a warning that is on a package of cigarettes that basically says this stuff will kill you, and it's been on there since I was a little kid, that is the problem. And the opposition to this legislation beautifully illuminates that problem. This legislation says if you are irresponsible in your consumption, or you allow your children to be irresponsible in their consumption over a long period of time, and it becomes obvious based upon what you see in the mirror, and you then reap the consequences of your actions, you shouldn't be able to blame somebody else. And I strongly support that the member, or encourage the members to support this. This is the kind of thing that if you went and walked the malls of this state and said, you know, there's opposition to this bill that says if you get into health problems because you're overweight, you shouldn't be able to blame somebody else. I can't even imagine what that polls at, but I can tell you it polls pretty high. And this is something that normal folks on the ground would agree is proper, and it's unfortunate that Senator Hahn has to be here, but, you know, it's kind of a natural outflow of the kinds of legislation and litigation we've seen for years.
Sir Latz.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, but that goes so far beyond what this bill does and makes a completely inappropriate analogy to smoking. If I eat a cheeseburger, Senator Thompson, it doesn't make you sick. But if I smoke in this room, it will make you sick, and it might kill you. 30 seconds exposure to that smoke could give you a heart attack, because your blood will start coagulating much faster just with 30 seconds exposure to the secondhand smoke. And that's what is the state law now in Minnesota. That was the smoking litigation. And people get that, which is why that polls over 70% in favor of the statewide smoking ban. This is a very different situation, and this is not about whether people are too stupid to keep eating cheeseburgers that are going to make them fat. It's a broader question about whether the state ought to be playing a role in creating immunities for an entire industry in the event that there ever could be causation shown. And Mr. Carlson was absolutely right. Causation would absolutely be the downfall of this kind of litigation. because you couldn't, it'd be very difficult, I would think near impossible, to prove that that the industry's simply creation of fatty foods would cause me to eat too much of it, okay? Because or to get fat as a result of it, because there are so many other factors involved in there. You'd be hard to pinpoint that. But the precedent and the purpose of this legislation in creating these kind of broad immunities is way beyond the scope of anything this state has ever done, and I think completely inappropriate. The exceptions created in Subdivision 4 are, I think, just a fig leaf. They don't do anything to the bill except allow people to proponents to point out that they're trying to be a little more reasonable in the language that they're proposing. So this bill really isn't necessary. I think it's being used by some to demagogue the issue. Frankly, any lawyers that took this on would, as Mr. Carlson pointed out, we'd be subjecting themselves probably to not only Chapter 549.211 sanctions, but also Rule 11 sanctions, unless they were able to somehow come up with a causal connection. And if they could come up with a causal connection, then they ought to be entitled to pursue that litigation. If they can come up with the facts that would actually prove that something that McDonald's did caused a person to eat too much of this to be fat and become obese, then McDonald's should face liability for that. I can't imagine a circumstance where that would occur. But if you can establish that causal connection, our whole civil system of justice is set up to allow for liability under those circumstances and to create such a broad swath of protection here. I mean, look, you got this long list of organizations that are supporting it. You know why? It's because they're industry and they don't want to be sued. Plain and simple. They're industry and they don't want to be sued. Well, which is the next step down the road here? What other causes of action don't they want to be sued for? That's no surprise. It's frankly unpersuasive to me. And I think the average person on the street would understand that, too. You don't need to make a law about this.
Senator Thompson.
Just briefly, I am told on the one hand that no lawyer could bring such a suit because you could never prove causation, but on the other hand, this is very dangerous legislation. Well, which is it? If there's no chance of this kind of suit being brought, then we don't have to worry about the legislation.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, Senator Hahn had to go a long ways for me to finally get involved in a situation where I disagree with him. But on this one, Senator Hahn and I do not see eye to eye. I'm going to oppose this bill for two basic reasons. And before I tell you why, I want you to understand that I'm not doing it because I'm trying to protect lawyers, because that's the first thing that goes to people's mind when a lawyer does something like this. I'm not, Senator Engebretson, trying to protect lawyers. I think lawyers are quite capable of protecting themselves, and they don't need me. The first basic reason why I'm going to oppose this legislation, as Mr. Carlson has already pointed out, is never in the history of the state of Minnesota has this lawsuit ever been brought forward. Never once. And I just think that we have got a whole lot better things to do with our time than to try and solve a problem that has never occurred. We're dealing with health care issues and in this committee with, you know, the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. I mean, some significant problems. And we are going to spend our Friday afternoon debating whether or not you can bring a lawsuit that's never occurred. And I just don't think it's a wise use of our time. I also would like to indicate to you that this case really is prohibiting what's called it's a form of products liability, where you bring a claim for money damages because there's a product out there that isn't good for you or is going to harm you or is dangerous. And in terms of civil cases, if we added up all of the civil cases in Minnesota filed in a given year, I believe you would be looking at under 5% of the total number of cases filed. And that includes product liability cases, automobile cases, premises liability cases, medical malpractice cases. It's a very small number. And here we're dealing with 0% of cases, of a very small number of cases filed in district court. I just think it's an absolute waste of time. The other thing that I wanted to bring to your attention is that I really do have some concerns as to the constitutional implications of this kind of prohibition. And there are two specific parts of our Constitution that I just very briefly I'm going to point out to you. And the first is the redress of injuries or wrong. Our Constitution says that every person is entitled to a certain remedy in the laws for all injuries or wrongs which he may receive to his person, property, or character, to obtain justice freely without purchase, completely and without denial, and without delay, conformable to the laws. This bill specifically outlaws a particular recognized cause of action, i.e., products liability. And so if you're concerned about that all of a sudden we're going to have a flood of these kinds of cases, there is another provision in our Constitution which provides the filter that this kind of a case that you're concerned about, which is spurious lawsuits and frivolous lawsuits brought by nefarious lawyers. And that filter is the right to a trial by a jury. What our Constitution says is that the right of a trial by jury shall remain inviolate and shall extend to all cases at law without regard to the amount in controversy. Lawyers do not decide damages in civil cases. Judges do not. It's juries that make those decisions. And so if, perchance, we were to have a whole bunch of these cases suddenly materialize, you simply run them through the jury system and let the people in the state of Minnesota decide whether or not these are meritorious claims or whether they are not meritorious claims. Candidly, I cannot think of a set of circumstances under which anybody would bring a lawsuit because they got fat for eating cheeseburgers. I can't imagine a lawyer doing it, and I can't imagine a person bringing that kind of a, what I would consider a frivolous lawsuit. But as soon as you pass this bill, there will be a set of circumstances that will arise that you have not anticipated, and you are going to prohibit somebody from exercising their constitutional right of redress. I'm going to, with that brief explanation as to where I'm coming from, Mr. Chairman, at this time I'm going to offer the A2 amendment. We could have that passed out.
Senator Newman moves the A2 amendment. Senator Hand, do you have a copy of the A2?
I do not.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, I'll wait till Senator Hand obtains a copy of the A2 amendment. And as succinctly as I can say, members, what I'm doing in Subdivision 3 is taking out the prohibition of bringing a cause of action and instead trying to insert some procedural protections that will maybe give you some degree of comfort that lawyers and potential plaintiffs aren't going to bring frivolous lawsuits. And What I want to bring to your attention is specifically that, what I do with it. A person would still be able to bring the action, but they better be very careful if they do, because if they bring this cause of action and they're not successful, I'm asking in this amendment that the court shall determine, that's mandatory, must determine the amount of all costs, not reasonable costs, all costs. And the cost incurred in litigation of this type, the most of those costs are going to be incurred in the areas of expert witnesses and attorney's fees. And you are talking substantial amounts of money, six figures. And oftentimes what the court will do is they will look at the cost of reasonable attorney's fees and they will simply reduce them. They will look at expert witness fees, which are really significant in a products liability case, and they will reduce them. And what this amendment is saying is we're taking away the discretion of the trial court and says you must award those fees unless you want. And all I'm trying to do here is give you some level of comfort that this will not be a frivolous lawsuit. And moreover, in the event that the plaintiff is not successful and is subjected to these fees, then the court must enter judgment in favor of the defendant and against the plaintiff. Seems to me that imposing procedural safeguards is a whole lot better way to go than to simply prohibit the right of an individual's right of redress. So that is the reason I am moving forward with this amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sarah Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And with all respect to my friend, Sir Newman, I would oppose the amendment. I understand his point about the procedural remedy, but the point I would make is that it's not just ending up in court that is the cost to retailers, producers, and others. It is the cost that they have to bear to prepare to go to court. It is the cost that they have to anticipate and try to outguess what the potential action or judgment of a jury might be. I think 10, 15 years ago, nobody would have contemplated that a jury would ever have awarded multiple millions of dollars or whatever it turned out to be for damages because somebody spilled hot coffee on themselves and blamed the retailer for that fact that they had hot coffee. There are things that we cannot contemplate in terms of what juries may or may not do. I've been a part of a school board where we have contemplated potential actions, also part of a food manufacturing company also contemplating actions. And there is a strong effort on the part of many businesses to avoid going to court. And sometimes that may lead them to make settlements because of the uncertainty that they find themselves in if they do go to court. And I think that is also a cost that we have to anticipate. And so while I understand the procedural remedy and don't doubt that it would be useful, I think the language in the bill as it stands is designed to protect a producer, manufacturer, retailer, and give them some certainty that they do not have to contemplate the costs, expenses related to potentially going to court to defend themselves against the idea that obesity on the part of an individual is their fault or that they have liability. So with all respect, I would suggest that the amendment be defeated.
To that point, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
First, with respect to the McDonald case that Senator Hamm just cited, I will tell you that I'm probably one of the few people in the room that's actually read the case. I could be wrong, but I've actually read it. And it was a much more complex case than simply spilling hot coffee in somebody's lap and involved a multitude of other issues. And I would just suggest that folks should not use that case as an example of a spurious or frivolous lawsuit because nothing could be further from the truth. I also would, insofar as the issue of costs, I would simply remind the members that, yes, there are costs that are incurred when we go into litigation. But I would remind you that, at least under the way our Constitution is written, it doesn't say you have a right of redress unless it's going to cost a lot of money. It does not say that you have a right of redress unless the legislature takes some type of action. It says you have a right of redress. And this bill prohibits that constitutional right. The other thing I would point out is think really hard about someone bringing a lawsuit of the type that Senator Hahn is concerned about and what I am concerned about in terms of costs. tens of thousands of dollars in attorney's fees, tens of thousands of dollars in expert witness fees. It is an extremely expensive proposition. Spurious lawsuits do not come forward when people are investing those kinds of sums. They are legitimate claims because they are on the hook for lots of money. And I candidly cannot describe for you, in my entire career, a single frivolous lawsuit brought forward by an attorney who is paying out-of-pocket expenses to the tune of tens of thousands of dollars. It simply does not happen. So think hard and long about whether or not this procedural amendment that I am offering will give you some comfort that I am correct, that that spurious, frivolous lawsuit is not coming forward. And if it does, then that nefarious lawyer's client that I was talking about, that irresponsible citizen, is going to get hooked with a judgment.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, with Senator Newman's amendment, I would be much preferring that we talk about reasonable amounts of cost rather than somebody stacking them up. But to the broader point, I think Senator Newman made some very good points, and I wanted to particularly focus on the bottom line one because we seem to have lost that in the discussion. Senator Thompson talked about people on the ground versus intelligentsia. The people on the ground are the ones who sit in the juries. It's the only time the ordinary citizen has a chance to make a decision on this when they hear all the facts that both sides can pay their best witnesses for and present them. And I just think that's the whole issue. I mean, we keep hearing all these big scare stories of what's going to happen, but who are we afraid making the judgment? 12 people? Our peers? I mean, I don't see what's wrong with letting them make the decision, and I think this amendment is a big step forward. I just know the way these attorneys are willing to rack up fees so quickly, I think the court should say reasonable in there, but I like your amendment. And I think the bottom line is we are saying that we don't trust the jury of our peers, and I frankly think that's one of the most important things in our Constitution, the one chance ordinary citizens have to have their say in what's right and what's wrong. And the idea that we're not going to allow anybody to let a jury decide anything related to this industry, I think this is big overkill, and I really appreciate your amendment, Senator Newman.
Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I do have read the McDonald's case, and the woman's name was Stella Liebeck. She had coffee spilled on her when she was getting it through a driver window at a pull-up McDonald's restaurant. They served it to her at over 180 degrees. It went between her legs, and she got third-degree burns on her inner thighs and genitalia, requiring multiple skin grafts. From that case, McDonald's revealed that they had over 700 cases of scalding from their coffee. And at trial, their witness testified that they had no intention of lowering the temperature of their coffee because they sell so many cups a day. If they brew it at that temperature, it saves them over $1 million a day. She asked McDonald's to pay $20,000 of medical bills that she incurred as a result of that injury. They refused, and that is why the jury awarded punitive damages against McDonald's and the $20,000 of compensatory. It was later reduced and changed, Mr. Chair, but that was certainly not a frivolous case, and it did change behavior. And when Senator Hand talks about, you know, they make business decisions based on their liability. And what I would submit to you is that this reduces their liability and their decisions that they're going to have to make about the food that we consume. Because they're going to say, I can kind of sell you what I want because I don't have responsibility for it. That's when you boil this down, that's what it says. And there is litigation about food, but you need to know that it isn't from consumers. You know, McDonald's sues Burger King over the Big Meal dispute. Coca-Cola sues Pepsi over the labeling of their Tropic drinks. Pepsi sues Coke over their energy drink claims. There is a lot of litigation that goes on between fast food companies. But there isn't anything going on with consumers, and our focus here is on frivolous cases, which has never happened. And I just think that this is not needed and sends a signal to the public that lawyers and our courts are spending their time on these kinds of non-meritorious, frivolous matters when it has never happened once. And, you know, Mr. Chairman, the amendment, we have generally been very resistant to loser pay amendments, and we have supported the American rule, which this tends to abrogate. But I see where you're going here, and I think that is much preferable as a tool to control a non-meritorious case over weight gain than to simply say a manufacturer is immune and take away their ability to act responsibly to the public. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To a couple of points that I've heard in your discussion with regards to the jury. Senator Marty so eloquently talked about the jury being judged by a group of our peers. Nobody's going to argue with that. I mean, that's a wonderful system. But the reality is, when we go to these kinds of lawsuits, we never get there. We always settle out of court. Hundreds and thousands of dollars settled out of court never gets to the jury. Because why? I'll use McDonald as an example. They just simply don't want to continue to fight legal fees. They don't want to continue to fight. We're going to settle out of court. It's tempting. They do. So the jury, a lot of times, unless they're actually class action suits, probably never hear them. Senator Newman, to say that we've never had any lawsuits that are foolish in this area, and I'm going to be a little away from where we're talking here, but I remember the cold mashed potatoes that the county sheriffs and the county boards had to deal with years ago when the mashed potatoes were to be served to the prisoners in jail. There was lawsuits over that. I mean, that's the kind of society we've come out to be here. Now, the legislature did address that, so they can't do that anymore. That we should have been out in front of that. This is very out in front of what potentially could happen here. So the idea, and I happen to agree with Senator Hand, the idea that part of the whole idea here is the cost of lawsuits, and your amendment does not address that. Certainly, I'm all in favor of the person bringing the frivolous lawsuit just because they're going to try and pad their wallet, and if they lose, they pay. I like that. I really do like that concept. I don't think anybody will ever argue with that. But the whole idea is we're going to be back in court, and somebody's going to make some money here over something this foolish. So to the amendment, Mr. Chair, I would ask the folks not to vote in favor of the amendment.
Mr. Chair.
To Mr. Ingebrigtsen's point.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Senator Ingebrigtsen's point about somebody's going to make some money here, I don't know if I have ever heard, at least in my career, an attorney taking a case, a personal injury case, which is this is, other than on a contingency fee basis. Now, I suppose that there are lawyers out there that will take it on an hourly basis, but these are most of the time they're contingency fee cases. So that lawyer isn't going to make any money. What he's going to do is he's going to lose a lot of money because he's going to have to spend it out of court. The spurious lawsuits, the frivolous lawsuits, Senator Ingebrigtsen and I was talking about, I'm talking about specifically what I was aware of and what I dealt with.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you. Well, to the contrary, Senator Newman, I have defended frivolous lawsuits. And I have seen lawyers try and develop niche lawsuits where if they can make a new area, open up a new area of law, then they can practice in that area and earn fees and take one small case into a whole career. And there are a lot of lawyers out there that will pay up front all the costs and fees of pursuing niche lawsuits because I've defended them. And I had one case that went all the way to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals actually awarded all attorneys' fees and costs against the lawyer because it was only the lawyer that had any risk and not the plaintiff at all. So there are those cases, and there are those lawyers, unfortunately, and I am concerned about the message we send that it's okay to do that, to use our courts that way to try and develop practice areas where the lawyers are personally invested in developing their career. I think Senator Hand's bill is well-intentioned, and I think the good part of what he's doing here is sending a message to litigants and potential litigants and to the potential defendants that Minnesota doesn't want to see those kinds of lawsuits. And I think that's a good message. We don't want this kind of overly zealous, challenging litigation to see if we can make great careers for lawyers. I don't think we need that. Now, Senator Newman, I appreciate what seems to me to be a pretty good compromise position. I kind of like your amendment that says you can do this, but it's entirely at your own risk if you can't establish it with a jury. And then the jury has to agree. I've seen juries overturned by their own judges in cases where juries have gone astray or where the judge allowed a case to get to the jury when it should not have. I've seen judges overturn their own juries. So it does happen. I hope that we can get something done. And, Senator Hand, I'll defer to you about your position on the A2 amendment, but I think the A2 amendment is better than nothing. And I think Minnesota does want to send that message. We don't want lawyers trying to use our courts to develop great, big, long-time profit-making careers at Minnesotans' expense.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to talk as the non-lawyer in this room, you know, the average everyday Joe that got her way into this legislature this last year. On this amendment, I understand Senator Newman's intentions, and I actually kind of like it for broad tort reform because I have been on the other side of product liability lawsuits. I know from, and I don't manufacture food. We manufacture things that go under the ground, but when roads cave in because of bad installation practice or whatever, and it was of no fault of our product at all, we still get included in the lawsuit. And we still spend tens of thousands of dollars defending ourselves, even if these things are settled out of court. And finally, at the board of directors area, that's where it ends up happening because you do not have the time or the energy to fight these things. You start looking at the checks you're writing out and the risk you're exposing your company to. But just to take your talent away from what we do well and have to defend against a product liability lawsuit where it has been proven that we didn't have the liability, but because we're the company with the deep pockets, we get attached. And so I will defer to Senator Hand on this amendment also. I like where you're going with this, Senator Newman. I think that's a broad tort reform lawsuit that we need to talk about. But I just want to talk on the other side of this issue, being somebody that's been on the side of those product liability lawsuits and having to be the company that's settled out of court, that we don't ever see the jury and we still end up paying and our insurance rates go through the roof and we're using our time and talent on stuff that our company isn't there to do. We're there to produce a product and keep jobs going, and it does increase the cost of doing business in the United States. So I'm going to defer to Senator Hand on this, so I will oppose the amendment because of Senator Hand, but I know where you're going, Senator Newman.
Senator Thompson. Well, Senator Latz first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to Senator Hoffman's point, I suspect for every situation in which a company, assuming as she did that it was proven that they had done absolutely nothing wrong. Of course, it never got to a jury, so there was no real proof that was in the judgment of the company itself. But even if we assume that to be the case, proven that they had no liability, for every time there's that situation, there's a lawsuit that's brought because the company wasn't forthcoming with information. The only way to get the information in the first place to find out if their product was manufactured wrongly is to file the lawsuit and go through the discovery process and make the company disclose the information that would allow the plaintiff to find out. Otherwise, the company could act without any checks and balances whatsoever.
Sometimes you do find out that the company messed up in their manufacturing process or that it was designed poorly, like lawnmowers or snowblowers that were designed poorly, and you end up with lost limbs as a result. So, but that's the individual facts of the individual cases. That's why we have a civil justice system, is to sort some of that stuff out. I'm wondering about the fee-shifting provision here offered by Senator Newman, which I think is certainly a step in the right direction, but I'd be curious as to some feedback. I'm not aware of any other law, but I might be completely ignorant on this, where we have a fee-shifting provision where the only in to the disadvantage of a losing plaintiff. I know we've got fee-shifting provisions for winning plaintiffs, where they, if they lose, they have covered all of their own costs and their own time. But if they win, because we want to, for public policy reasons, to encourage those kind of lawsuits, then the defendant will pay their fees. For example, in the Human Rights Act, we have those provisions. I know there are others. Do we have anything in law currently where the fee shift is only in favor of a defendant that wins? Does Ms. Pontius happen to know? Because that's essentially what this amendment would do.
Ms. Pontius.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Letts, I can't think of anything off the top of my head. I know we have some where it's the prevailing party, but I need to look into it more. But nothing jumps to mind that does that.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder whether what Senator Newman's reaction would be to a suggestion that we just make this a prevailing party rather than just a prevailing defendant, so that if the plaintiff is successful in winning, beyond all odds and expectations, but if they are successful in proving causation and everything else in liability, then they get their attorney's fees and costs paid by the defendant. And if they lose, then they're on the hook for the same that's in the amendment.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Letts, I am not aware of any fee-shifting statute similar to the one that is described in the A2 amendment. What I was trying to do here is provide a good degree of comfort to those who think it's imperative that we outlaw lawsuits that, frankly, have never come to fruition in Minnesota. My normal reaction to fee-shifting statutes is to make it mutual. This is a stark deviation in what I would normally believe to be appropriate. But I will say that I will not oppose an amendment to the amendment if someone wants to make this run in favor of the prevailing party. And I say that because I think that it's very unlikely that a plaintiff is going to be successful in this kind of a lawsuit.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, It's kind of funny how the conversation is going here. It's never going to happen, but we're going to now make sure that one gets paid or the other one doesn't get paid. Bothers me a little bit. It seals the deal with me that it can happen. It probably will happen. And I do have one question, and maybe it'll help me clear it up a little bit too. Mr. Carlson, you mentioned attorneys would be sanctioned under 549.211. Can you explain that?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair and members, are happy to have counsel explain as well. 549.21 is a law that was adopted in 1997 by the legislature to control cases that don't have merit. And it requires lawyers who are signing pleadings to acknowledge that the case is brought in good faith, that there's substantial legal basis for the claim that they're making, and that they understand that they're subject to sanction if they don't have legal authority for the filing that they're making. That's a roundabout way of saying what 549.211 does. There's also a court rule, Rule 11, which gives the courts, not statutorily, but gives the courts the discretion to impose sanctions and fees against lawyers for filing frivolous litigation or non-meritorious appeals or defenses. And so the court has that authority as well.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up. So what would be the sanction? What would be the sanction on what we're talking about today? In your view, what would be the sanction of an attorney that was going to take a lawsuit against a fast food facility, a fast food vendor here in Minnesota, and they were to be found, it to be found frivolous? What kind of a sanction would an attorney?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, without speculating for the courts, I would suggest that the sanction that would be imposed on someone for bringing a purely frivolous case would be very similar to the language in Senator Newman's amendment. They would award, whether it's reasonable or all fees, costs of litigation. They can impose other monetary sanctions as well as sanctions on their professional license. Or they can actually request that a sanction be put on their professional license. I think that has to go to the Supreme Court for adjudication. But.
Sarah Hand.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and I appreciate the discussion. I would oppose the amendment even as amended, but I would like to remind members that what we're talking about here is a very narrow claim. Many of the things that are being contemplated in this discussion would be appropriate if we're talking about, you know, actions that would involve product liability or – that's not what this is about. It is simply about the – can a person say, I ate too much food and it's your fault? That's really what it is. That's all it is. And I understand people say, well, that hasn't happened in Minnesota. It hasn't happened. It has happened in other places. It has happened in Brazil against McDonald's. I can't sit here today and predict what the climate of public opinion or the climate of legal progress or what might happen. I know we today see things happen that 10, 15 years ago no one would have contemplated. We have bans of trans fats and salt in cities and municipalities based on obesity and other kinds of – and we also know that there is great concern about obesity. The real question here, and in Minnesota I think it is particularly pertinent because we have such a large food-related industry. This applies not just to the big McDonald's and Wendy's and so forth, but it would apply to local producers, grocers, retailers. Look at all the many things in our communities that are retailing food. And if we say that it's possible that at some point some theoretician or some body of evidence might end up establishing, you know, there's an addictive nature of food. That was one of the claims that was brought against McDonald's by a guy who said he claimed he was addicted to the food. What if that claim becomes somehow substantiated in somebody's mind and they bring the point is, what we're trying to get at here is if I eat too much, can I blame somebody else for that? And can I bring a lawsuit that even if it doesn't go to court, could have the potential of bringing a lot of cost into the already costly food chain that we have. Do we want to do that? And so I understand the legal discussion about how we want to limit or allocate costs and potential lawsuits, but again, this is not anything to do with limiting liability cases against manufacturers for tainted products or for bad behavior or for mislabeling or any of those conditions. Those are all permitted. The only thing that this is pointed at is, can I blame somebody else for my decisions about eating? That's all it is. And so I don't want to get the conversation to get brought into theoretical cases that may have nothing to do with the bill that's in front of you.
Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. A couple of points. First of all, I can make a copy for the committee, but I actually am aware of the Brazilian case. And I have an article from the Labor and Employment section from the American Bar Association. That was a workers' compensation case from an employee against McDonald's in Brazil, which has a completely different set of civil standards than we do in the U.S., including they have no right to a jury trial except for cases of murder. But this was an employee case. That to use the Brazil case is what could happen here is absolutely wrong, because that would be barred in Minnesota. Workers' compensation is an exclusive remedy, and so to use that case as an example is just clearly not accurate, Senator, not that you even know about the background of that case, but that would clearly be barred in Minnesota because of the exclusive remedy that workers' compensation provides. If the bill is just to be about weight gain, Mr. Chairman and members, you need to make an amendment to the bill on lines 1.21. My biggest concern about this bill is that it is not simply about eating too many cheeseburgers and gaining weight. It deals with a health condition associated with weight gain. And if it were only limited to weight gain cases, I ate too many cheeseburgers, I got fat, that's one thing. That's not what this bill does, and that gives us great concern.
Mr. Carlson, our focus is on the A2 amendment right now rather than on the bill. Senator Thompson.
You know, Mr. Chair, I think my comments would probably be more proper in the context of the bill rather than the amendment, right. So I would ask to be called upon later, but I'll defer for now.
All right. Senator Newman, on the amendment.
Yeah, my comments were going to be addressing what Senator Hamm last mentioned, but in reality is more appropriate to the bill, so I will withhold until.
Okay. I think we've had a good airing of the amendment. The amendment is before us. Is there further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
The amendment does not prevail.
Division.
Division has been called. All those in favor, raise your hand. And all those opposed, raise their hand.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Ortman back there. Can you raise your hands again one more time?
Hands?
and opposed, raise your hand. Chair's ears are good. Opposed. The bill is before us. Any further discussion? Senator Thompson?
Just a couple of things. One is to just back up Senator Hand's point that this is about one specific issue, and obviously it relates to the health conditions related to obesity. I do want to address an issue raised by Senator Newman that while we disagree, you raise a very legitimate issue, and that is the issue of the Constitution providing for redress of grievances. And in fact, Senator Gazelka had a bill before the Commerce Committee that I objected to on the very same grounds. I felt it limited an individual's ability for redress, and in fact told him that that would have to be corrected before I'd voted out of this committee. The reason, Senator Newman, I think this is different is this is a matter of defining what a grievance is. And in that's what courts and legislatures do. For example, and we many, many times define what a grievance is and how it can be addressed. For example, the example of workers' compensation has been brought up. The legislature, when it enacted the workers' comp law, essentially took away the right for an employee of a company to sue under tort law. Now replaced it with something else, admittedly, the workers' compensation law, which, you know, we can argue back and forth all we want. The point is, this is simply saying that if you become overweight, you can't go blame the people that served you the food. And we're saying that's not a grievance. It's not a matter of how much can you get for that. And again, I think that most people would agree with that. So I do, Senator Newman, share your constitutional sensibilities there. I just don't think that applies in this instance.
Sir Ann.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and I certainly appreciate Senator Thompson's concern, and I would agree that is the intent, is to try to exclude certain claims from being treated as if they were legitimate. And I would just point out that this is, again, related to weight gain, obesity, or health condition associated with weight gain or obesity and resulting from the use and consumption. So the point is, again, if I get overweight and if I become diabetic because I'm overweight, and I want to say that it's not my fault, but it's the fault of the person who I bought the food from, that is not a grievance. that you may have some other claim if you've got a product that you were told was something and it turns out to not be that thing. That's a different matter. This does not provide for any prohibition for people pursuing an action on the basis of faulty or false or misleading information. It's simply very narrowly constructed to say, if you eat too much and if you have a health condition that results from that, you cannot blame the people you buy the food from. That's all it is. And I think that as a prospective marker to suggest to people and I think, frankly, to give assurance to businesses and agricultural producers in this state, I think that's important. I think it's an important signal. And so I would urge members to consider the bill favorably and that we would take action on it.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to mention Senator Hand's comment about this is a matter about eating too much and blaming somebody else. And I would respectfully disagree. This, to me, is really a constitutional issue. And I will tell you that people have car accidents all the time, get hurt, and blame somebody else. So that really, to me, is not the issue. To what Senator Thompson was talking about, the part in the Constitution that talks about the redress of grievances and the conformable with the laws, you know, we have to interpret the Constitution a little bit. There are those of us that are not necessarily strict constructionists. There are those who are think that the document can be interpreted in a wide variety of ways. I'm someplace in the middle. And I think what that clause says is that we have a right to put in place procedural safeguards, but we can't take away the right of people to go to court. That's just what I think. And I don't also think, Senator Thompson, that we can pick and choose those portions of the Constitution that we agree with and ignore the parts that we just happen to disagree with. And you are in an area where a lot of people disagree with that right to go to court, that right of redress. And there's nothing in that Constitution that talks about costs. There's nothing in there that talks about the right of redress except when the legislature acts otherwise. Nothing. And so, to me, that is a very, very important part of this discussion. It is not about blaming somebody else for your misconduct or failing to take personal responsibility for your own actions. With that in mind, Mr. Chair, as I'm sitting here, I'm thinking that perhaps a procedural safeguard, if the amendment that I offered wasn't acceptable, perhaps we should explore the procedural safeguards similar to medical malpractice cases, wherein we utilize a system of expert review to try and avoid those frivolous lawsuits. And if we could put in place those kinds of safeguards without the necessity of flying directly in the face of what I believe our Constitution to say, that would then make some sense to me, and I think that we have a right to do that. So in order to perhaps give us a little bit of time to put together an amendment to deal with a system of expert review similar to medical malpractice cases, Mr. Chairman, I would move that this matter be laid on the table to give us that opportunity.
That motion is not debatable. Everyone understand the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion does not prevail. Division has been called for. All those who are in favor of the motion, raise your hand. 2, 3. Oops. And all those opposed, raise their hand. The motion does not prevail. The bill is before us. Any further discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I would move the A1 amendment.
The A1 amendment has been moved. Senator Newman, I think everyone has gotten a copy of it. Why don't you begin your explanation?
Very, very quickly, Mr. Chair, and I don't think that this is going to take a lot of discussion. Article 1, Section 8 is the right of redress in our Constitution, and I'm offering this amendment simply because if this bill goes forward, I want to make sure that if by some chance litigation does arise and the case is ultimately appealed to the Minnesota State Supreme Court, I want to make sure that the Supreme Court is aware of the fact that we talked about the right of redress and we were aware of the Constitution and nevertheless decided to proceed with this bill. So with that explanation, Mr. Chair, I offer the A1 amendment.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And again, with all respect to my friend, Senator Newman, I would oppose the A1 amendment. I am a little confused by the debate. On the one hand, I'm hearing that the purpose of this bill is non-existent because there never will be such a case. And then we've spent the last 45 minutes debating amendments that would provide safeguards in the event that those cases were brought to try to make them be more constitutional or to work better. I don't know what the I guess I'm getting a confused signal here from opponents of the bill. I think that certainly what we're offering is, in my understanding, is within the constitutional bounds of the Constitution. I don't think that we need to point out that it's somehow potentially violation of the Constitution. I do think it's within our purview as a legislature to make a definition about what things are legitimate to be brought to a court, and that's what I think this represents. So I'd oppose the amendment.
Senator Ortman, did you have a comment?
Well, and I just want to say, as much as I respect Senator Newman's opposition to the bill, I just don't think this has any impact whatsoever. It just doesn't accomplish anything, and maybe it's comfort language for somebody that is struggling with this bill, but I think we can't contravene the Constitution anyway. So if the bill is unconstitutional for any basis, the Supreme Court won't enforce it. So I just don't think this accomplishes anything.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Ortman, thank you for that explanation. And with that explanation, I will withdraw my amendment.
Amendment has been withdrawn. Any further amendments? Any further discussion? Hearing none. Oh, Senator Letts.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, just to Senator Hand's point, if there isn't a problem here, then we don't need this bill at all. And I don't know why you're here in this committee right now. If your assumption is that there is potentially a problem, and I think the committee has to accept for purposes of analyzing the legislation that's a potentiality, and it's our duty to try to at least make the legislation better if we can, and thereby we have these amendments. But I don't think you can turn that on its head as an argument against or for the bill itself. We're operating based on your bill in front of us. I'm awfully concerned about subdivision 4 because I think that it, although it purports to permit some actions, especially paragraph 2, is so narrowly defined as to be meaningless. And I think I'd offer an oral amendment on line 2.7 to put a period after the word food and delete the rest of that line and line 2.8 and 2.9. I'm sorry, delete up through the word reckless, which on line 2.8, which was the subject of an earlier amendment.
Could you repeat the amendment, Senator Letts?
Yeah, on line 2.7, put a period after the word food, delete the rest of that line, and delete line 2.8. No, I'm sorry. I don't want a period after the word food. I just want to delete everything after the word food on 2.7 and delete 2.8 up through the word reckless. So it would read, or sale of food and the claimed injury was proximately caused by the violation. So if you've got a material violation of federal or state law applicable to the manufacturing, marketing, distribution, advertising, labeling, or sale of food, and you get the claimed injury proximately caused by that violation, you still have a viable cause of action.
So it's labeled as reckless.
Any discussion? Senator Hand.
Mr. Chair, I'm trying to understand what the amendment does to the language.
Senator Artman.
Mr. Chair, I would support the amendment. I'm not sure I see any problem with it. If there's any other material violation of federal or state law, then the claim can still go forward, and I would think that Senator Hand would be supportive of that if it's a violation of law. That is the basis of the lawsuit.
Mr. Chair,
Could we, Senator Latz, could you, for counsel's sake, could you reread your amendment so everyone understands?
Sure. Line 2.7, after the word food, delete if the. On line 2.8, delete everything through the word reckless.
Through the word reckless?
Yes. Through and including the word reckless.
And what would be the rest of the...
Reckless was added in...
What would be the rest of the language on that?
So then it would just, it would read, or sale of food and the claimed injury was proximately caused by the violation.
I think it was the if then.
I am kind of amalgamating the other amendments.
Senator Latz, we have a suggestion from counsel.
Yes.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I was just going to suggest leaving the if the in, and then just say claimed injury was proximately caused by the violation.
That works, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Latz incorporates that into his amendment. Any further discussion? Senator Hand?
Well, Mr. Chair, I I'm not certain if that has an effect on the claim of injury and the other as it applies to other violations of law. The narrowing to knowing and willful, and as it was amended, reckless included, as was done in the other body. I am not certain what the argument was there, not having not been at that hearing, but I'm certainly willing to defer to the committee. I guess I don't oppose the amendment. So,
counsel, would you have any, or would you be able to answer any of the concern of the author on whether or not this amendment would have any other ramification to the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I think it just would broaden this exception, so it wouldn't be limited to cases where there was a knowing, willful, or reckless violation.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ingerbridge.
Mr. Chair, I'm just not clear on what is changing the bill on this thing, just in general.
Senator Latz.
Is there a large change here?
Latz, what would be the impact of your amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I believe the impact would be that liability would follow from a material violation of law applicable to the conduct. Just the violation and the causal connection between that violation and the claimed injury. So under the current provision in the bill, you'd have to prove that the violation was done knowingly, willfully, or intentionally, and recklessly, which is, I'm not quite sure how that fits in there, but recklessly is sort of an intentional disregard for whether or not that will be the impact, which is a little bit different than willful, but it takes out that sort of intent component and just says if you violate state law and the injury and that violation caused the injury, then you're still subject to liability in the courts. You still have to prove your case, but you don't get the well, that's what it would do.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wardman.
The way I read it is that a lawsuit could still go forward if there is an underlying violation of law that forms the basis of the case. So it's not just that you've become obese because of your purchases. Now it's there are other laws, and I think that's what this is saying, is that we're not going to limit anybody from bringing a lawsuit if there was an underlying violation of state or federal law that was the proximate cause or the cause for your injury. I think it makes sense, but that's the way I read it.
Sorry, Ann.
Again, Mr. Chairman, I'll defer to the judgment of the committee. I suspect there may have been some testimony in the other body that caused them to adopt the amendment they did, but I'm not privy to that. And in my opinion, I don't know that this does any harm to the bill. So I guess I'd leave it to the judgment of the committee.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Carlson.
I was at the House hearing. This was actually added in the Agriculture Committee, and they were trying to get right where Senator Ortman is at, which is they were trying to get close to the standard in 604 on comparative fault with its because it was just a knowing violation, and they just added that language to try and get to how other civil claims would be handled when there's a material violation of a statute. So that's why they were trying to make it not less restrictive, or they're trying to make it more like other claims, and this just makes it completely like other claims.
Your last statement.
By deleting the knowing, willful, and reckless, you're just making this section like other claims where there's a material violation of a statute. You wouldn't have that additional higher burden of knowing, and proving knowledge is extremely difficult, as I think the counsel on the committee can tell you.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor of the Latz oral amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Or amendment is adopted. Senator Ortman?
Mr. Chair, to the bill.
And
Senator Hahn, I'd like to move the bill on your behalf. I don't know, Mr. Chair, where the bill needs to go. We go to the floor?
It's going to the floor.
Mr. Chair, I would move that Senate File 160 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. And I just want to speak briefly about why I think we should do this. I supported Senator Newman's amendment, but notwithstanding that, I think it is really important that we send this message that we still believe in personal responsibility in the state of Minnesota. That if I go to lunch and I buy Sprite Zero and a vegetarian cup of chili, that's my choice. And if Senator Hahn goes and he buys Coca-Cola and a cheeseburger, that's his choice. And we still have a society where McDonald's can sell whatever they want, provided they've met all other legal requirements, and Senator Hahn can buy all the cheeseburgers and Cokes that he wants. That's a fundamental, basic principle of freedom and liberty. And I think we need to set the record that we're not going to let our courts be used in a way that destroys that fundamental principle. And so, Senator Hahn, I know how many years you've worked on this bill, and I appreciate what you're trying to accomplish here. And to those people that say, what's the harm? There's never been a lawsuit, or there's nobody here that's been hurt by this. I am so tired of hearing that in all the committees I've been on this year. I've never heard it more. And it seems like in the past, every time somebody had a bill, they would bring somebody who was injured or hurt or had were vulnerable and said, I'm hurt, I need the state to address my problem or my wrong or my injury. And I want to say, wait, stop, slow down. We've got a principle of personal responsibility around here. The government cannot provide for everything. But it is our job as policymakers to set some standards. And I think that's exactly what Senator Hahn is doing. He is setting a standard and a message to our community that we don't want these kind of lawsuits. We want it remind folks of their personal responsibilities. And Senator Hahn, I appreciate your work on it, and I will be supporting your bill.
Senator Erdman has moved the Senate file 160 be recommended to pass and be moved to the floor. Senator Hahn, before we make that vote, could I ask you what you had for lunch today?
Well, coincidentally, I did have a cheeseburger.
Okay.
And a Coke. And I respect the choices that Senator Ortman and others may make about their food choices, but I appreciate the thoughtful consideration of this committee. Being a former member on the committee, I do know that it is your job, and I respect that, to try to make bills better. There is no other committee that I'm familiar with in the Senate that spends as much time laboring over what words mean. And I think that's a good thing, and I appreciate the effort, and thank you for your consideration.
Mr. Chairman, I also appreciate all the time the committee's given the bills that I've worked on today, and I appreciate it very much. Senator Ortman, I agree with everything you say. My concern with this bill is when there's something in your Sprite that causes you a negative health condition, that we're taking away the right for someone to be compensated for that. That's my concern.
Mr. Chair, to that point, that's exactly what is addressed in subdivision 4 of the bill, exactly that example.
Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to speak for or against this bill? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee.
Senator Ortman, would you grab the helm here?
Parts of this bill is
discussing.
Hey, Kathy. How's your day?
Julianne got some a few minutes ago.
Uh-oh. Senator Limmer's up again.
Oh, don't. Don't prejudice the jury, Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer, member, has Senate File 509. It's the voter photo identification requirement with the picture identification issuance provisions and balloting procedures. Members, we have heard this bill in many committees, and I would ask if Ms. Pontius would just remind the members what the jurisdiction is of this committee with respect to this bill. Maybe it's everything, or maybe it's a part. Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair and members, you should have, I think, a copy of a summary where I tried to focus you on what I saw as potential judiciary issues. Most of them relate to either data collection or classification. There's also an amendment to the felony election law statute. If you'd like, I can just run through this really quick.
Yeah, I think that would help.
Of course, the first one is page 1, section 1, and that's an amendment to the Data Practices Act that classifies the Department of Public Safety data that'll be on these applicants for the new voter identification card as private data. It's consistent with how driver's license and Minnesota identification cards are handled right now. Federal law, in fact, requires that access to the data be restricted, but because this voter identification card is kind of a unique new creature, it's not clearly under those other laws, so this would specifically make that data private, although it could be released to law enforcement or a government entity for purposes, or a court for purposes out of carrying out its functions. That's language that's taken out of the federal law that's applicable to driver's licenses. And then the next one is Article 1, Section 6, which is on page 6. And this is the application for voter identification card. I focused on specifically the information that's required to be provided in the application. And then Article 1, Section 10, which is on page 7, this is the current law that deals with the photographs that are maintained by the Department of Public Safety for driver's licenses identification cards. and basically just adds the voter identification cards into those provisions. So the photographs are private data, and also the use of those photographs is restricted.
Thank you, members. Any questions about the jurisdiction of the committee and what we're trying to work on here today? Okay. There's more.
Manager, then there's let's see. On Article 1, Section 14, which is on page 9, this is a provision that deals with the use of Social Security numbers in driver's license and ID card, and it just adds the voter identification card into those provisions. And then Article 1, Section 15, also on page 9, this, again, just adds the voter ID cards into the provisions under current law that allow somebody to use a religious objection to a photograph and then also to permit the wearing of certain headgear in photographs. And then we've got, let's see, Article 1, Section 24, which is on page 19. This is the felony provision. And current law makes various misrepresentations of identity a felony. And this also adds requesting a provisional ballot or requesting that a provisional ballot be counted, misrepresenting your identity and doing that. And then Article 2, Section 4, which is on page 24, this requires the Secretary of State, they maintain a statewide voter registration system right now, and it requires it to include reports on individuals who are not registered and who are believed to be ineligible to vote, to the extent permitted by federal law. And then Article 2, Section 12, which is on page 29, requires the Secretary of State to maintain an electronic database of individuals who are not registered, who are believed to be ineligible to vote. That would be like felons whose civil rights haven't been restored, persons under a guardianship, or those who are legally incompetent. And information that has to be included in the database is specified. Article 2, Section 14, which is on page 31, this amends the information that has to be provided as part of an absentee ballot under current law. And right now, the application for an absentee ballot has to include your driver, either your driver's license number, state ID number, last four digits of your Social Security number, or a statement that you don't have any of those numbers. And with this amendment, all of that information would be required in the application for an absentee ballot. And then Article 3, Section 3, which is on page 40, provides for the use of an electronic roster, which would be a secure electronic connection to the statewide voter registration system. And this is something that's optional with precincts. I just kind of flagged some of these provisions in Article 3 just because they do involve electronic data systems, but there are provisions in there dealing with the security of the data, encryption requirements, et cetera. And that's all identified.
Ms. Pontius, any questions from the committee about the jurisdiction or about any of the descriptions provided by Ms. Pontius? If not, then Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, I have an amendment, an author's amendment. This is not the committee of original jurisdiction, so we'll have to vote on it separately.
You'll have to earn our support, Senator Limmer.
As always.
Thank you. Do you have the amendment before you? Senator Limmer has the A46 amendment. Senator Limmer, will you describe the effect of the amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair. If I can bring your attention in the bill to page 6, line 6. Before the word residence, insert and insert a semicolon. I've just seen it for the first time, Madam Chair. And delete line 7. I see that on line 6 there's another word "and" there. I'm not sure if we're supposed to get rid of that. I think we are, if we're inserting an "and," or I suppose we could have gotten rid of the word "address" and comma.
So, Senator Limmer, if I get you right, then what you're doing is taking out the requirement that an applicant provide a Social Security number.
We would be taking out the Social Security number requirement.
Thank you, Senator Limmer. Questions or comments from members of the committee? Seeing none, are there folks here that would like to testify one way or the other on the amendment that's been offered by Senator Limmer, the A46? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A4, I'm sorry.
Senator, on page 4.
Can you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Yes, I will. My name is Carolyn Jackson. I'm with the ACLU of Minnesota.
Thank you,
I believe
Jackson.
On page 4 there's also a requirement that they gather the Social Security number. And it's actually in current law that you gather the Social Security number for a driver's license. And because you're getting this information for the voter ID card as well, I think you have the same problem. It's on page 6.
Well, Ms. Jackson, do you support the change that Senator Limmer offers on page 6?
I do.
So perhaps we could deal with that first and then go back and see if there's something we can do to assist you or with Senator Limmer on page 4.
Fantastic.
So seeing no other comments or questions about the A46 amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. The A46 is adopted. And Ms. Pontius, can you work on, she's going to work on the language to address Ms. Jackson's concern on page 4. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brief discussion or description of the bill so we put things a little bit in context. Senate File 509 is the bill to require a photo identification in order to vote in the state of Minnesota. The bill establishes a photo ID requirement, provisional balloting processes. It delves into the election administration and all for the purposes of establishing a secure system that would be described for the public as one of integrity. There is a voter ID card that's created for those who would not, let me back up. We would require a government-sponsored identification card that would have a photograph to be used for balloting. Right now, we could currently use a driver's license, a Minnesota ID card. There are a few people, surprisingly, that don't even have identification formally on their person. They have, they simply don't use it. The Department of Public Safety has estimated that number to be about 144,000 people in the state of Minnesota. Many of them don't vote either, but nevertheless, we did not want to create going in the direction of requiring a photo identification. We did not want to require a cost. If we imposed a cost, that would be considered a poll tax, and that, of course, would be unconstitutional. So in order to provide them an identification card with a photo on it, sponsored by the state of Minnesota, we created a free ID card for the express purposes of voting. This would be available to anyone who requested it that could not afford one. And it's financed through special revenue funds that have come out of the Department of Transportation, as well as some HAVA funds that are currently formally undesignated. The bill itself does create not only the mechanism for that, it allows for electronic rosters to be used by cities who voluntarily wish to use that system at their expense. So the state would not have an expense for that system. The voter ID cards share would share many features as any other driver's license or ID card. They're good for 4 years, and over the age of 65, they would be issued for life. Currently, as I mentioned, Minnesota's driver license, state ID card, or this voter ID card could be used in order to vote. Tribal IDs that contain all information contained on a Minnesota ID card also would be used. In order to apply for a driver's license or an ID card, one could use a driver's license, ID card, U.S. passport, a Minnesota or a federal ID card, a student ID from an accredited post-secondary institution in Minnesota could also be used, and then in conjunction with a registry that would be provided by the institution. If the voter is a student, as I mentioned, and it did not contain an address, a current student fee statement that contains a student address could be used. If the voter resides in a residential facility, the voter may have an administrator vouch for him under a signed oath. The range of ID sufficient for Election Day voting is narrower than Election Day registration. Before an applicant signs the polling place roster, an election judge must require the voter to show up photo identification and confirm the name and address and date of birth of the individual. The photo ID documents that satisfy the photo ID requirement are the following: a Minnesota driver's license or ID card, or a new voter ID card, receipt for a new, renewed, or updated driver's license or ID card, and an expired or otherwise non-current driver's license. I just got my driver's license updated. You know that whenever you do that, you get a yellow receipt. It's got all your data on it with your current address, but your old driver's license has a corner clipped on it, and wherever you go as a driver, you have to carry both of those documents with you. It would be the same application as in this if we were doing that, and of course a tribal ID card. There is provisional balloting required. I know I'm getting a little far astray from some of the other jurisdiction, but I just wanted the committee to know that this is a rather far-ranging bill. I think I've kind of covered just about all of the aspects for the jurisdiction of the committee.
Thank you, Senator Limmer. Questions or comments from the committee? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if I could just wander a little ways here, Senator Limmer, you mentioned about electronic rosters. These small townships that we have in rural Minnesota, we're concerned about having to, this being a burden to them. Can you address that a little bit?
Madam Chair, there is no formal requirement for electronic rosters. It would only be on a city that would wish to use that. Perhaps they're large, perhaps they have the financial base to do so, but that would be entirely voluntary on the part of the municipality.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments from committee members? Mr. McGrath, are you here to testify regarding the bill?
I am here at Senator Limmer's pleasure.
If there's any questions.
Senator Limmer? If not, then we have other folks that are here to testify. We have, I'm sorry, Senator Marty.
No, Madam Chair, I was just asking who all you have to testify. How long is the list?
About 3 hours. No, I'm kidding.
At this stage,
no,
I'm not sure.
We have Mr. Greg O'Connor has asked to speak, and Lori Ullman has asked to speak, and there may be others here, but those are the only ones I'm aware of, Senator Marty.
Thank you.
And Mr. O'Connor from the Republican Liberty Caucus is here.
Yes.
Mr. O'Connor, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I will be brief. I think this is only 2 minutes worth. My name for the record is Greg O'Connor, and I have been a small business owner for the last 42 years, and more recently the Director of Legislative Affairs for the Republican Liberty Caucus. I think when we're talking about voting, it's important to remember that the right to vote and the casting and counting of our vote represent the only voice we citizens have, the ultimate power, if you will, to select those who will make decisions that will directly impact the direction of government and the role it will play in our lives and our businesses. What we see being done through this legislation is to take additional, reasonable, common sense steps to make our voting system as foolproof as possible, assuring that each citizen's vote counts and that that vote is only cast by a citizen. It seems to me that protecting the integrity of that system is one of the highest responsibilities of government. Suggesting that there might be some comparatively small additional cost, to me, is a non-starter as an argument. And in conclusion, a couple of reflections from the Founding Fathers come to mind. James Madison, in his 51st Federalist paper, talked about, quote, if men were angels. But maybe more to the point, Thomas Jefferson told us, quote, in questions of power, let no more be heard of confidence in man, but bind him down for mischief by the chains of the Constitution, end quote. If you'll substitute this bill for the word Constitution in that statement, I think you have it. I urge unanimous support in favor of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. O'Connor. Questions for Mr. O'Connor? Then we also have with us Lori Ullman, the City Council member from the City of Nalvin. Is she here? Not seeing her. Are there others here that would like to testify either in support or in opposition to Senate File 509? For those following on the record, Ms. Jackson brought some concerns about page 4 of the bill, and Council has an answer, so we'll allow Ms. Pontius to answer the question, and then if you have follow-up, Ms. Jackson, we'll get back to you.
Okay, I was just going, this is Carolyn Jackson. I was going to withdraw my objection.
Thank you. I just want to make sure for the record people know, because you did raise a question, and I think we should have the answer. Ms. Pontius?
Oh, yeah, Madam Chair and members, actually that section of law now would apply to everything but the voter ID card, and that's why it's in the bill. So this is the application process for like the driver's license and everything else, and then the other section is just for the voter ID bill. So.
Thank you. Other folks that would like to testify, either for or against Senator Limmer's Senate File 509, questions or comments from the committee? Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I've obviously heard a lot about the bill, but I've never been on a committee that's heard the bill. And I'm just curious who you're trying to, I mean, the photo ID does not catch the felon voters, the ineligible voters for that. It doesn't catch the non-citizens. At least I don't think it catches any of those. How many people you think this is going to, people who are voting fraudulently right now, how many people you think this is going to stop from voting fraudulently now? I mean, I keep hearing from the county attorneys that there's very, very few cases, and most of those are felons, and are felons who have not had their rights restored, and they're voting that way, and this doesn't do anything about that. How many people do you think this might help an election judge find out is voting improperly?
Well, Senator Marty.
Senator Limmer.
Senator Marty, the intent of the bill is to modernize and secure the voting ballot. We now live in a world where we have the capability of doing that. We relying on a 19th century voting system, I think, is not to the best advantage of our society or to the betterment of our people. The public deserves to have confidence in the integrity of our election system. And introducing a requirement that identifies who the individual is by a visual form, as well as knowing if they actually do live in the precinct that they come from, is a good thing. And it's a thing that will modernize our election system in a good way. Changing times call for a photo ID. In all of the ways of looking at how people take advantage of any system, this is a good consideration to make for our time. And you know, quite often in our world, modern day life, we see a photo identification used for a lot of different purposes. We see it for the use of transactions. If you use a check or a credit card, you can't open up a bank account without it. You can't get on an airplane without it nowadays. I can't even dump leaves in the Maple Grove leaf dump without presenting a photo ID to that to that location. And now, if a leaf dump requires an identification, I would think that our voting process should require that. Right now, all one has to do, if you're pre-registered, just show up on election day and sign the registry. You do have to check in with the registration desk, but other than that, you don't have to present any photographic identity. And literally, you could be anyone that you say you are. So this is a time when we have the technology, we have the security, and I think we have the a high integrity just in the process of what we can create to provide that. And that's why this bill is before us. Now, Mr. McGrath here is a sponsor of the bill, and he has some of the other questions or answers to the questions that you have raised regarding felon voting and other aspects on a technical basis for the bill.
Madam Chair, I guess that is the one point. I mean, how many people, because this won't affect the number of felons voting, presumably. I mean, the photo does not do anything to identify. Driver's license, as far as I know, doesn't say I've got a felony conviction or not have a felony conviction on it. So how many people do you think this might affect that way?
Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, I haven't looked into that. I'm looking at creating a mechanism that's secure and a system that has that will gain the confidence of our citizen. I don't think our citizens have confidence in the way we vote in the state of Minnesota.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, the reason I'm asking that is because you talk as if how bizarre it is that somebody in our society doesn't have a photo ID because you need it for an airplane flight, you need it for dumping leaves. We all assume everybody's in our situation, and I keep thinking of college students who are certainly not a current photo ID. I've known so many people who don't change their license right away when they move. I think you have 90 days, but I know a lot who don't do it then. And I keep thinking about all the seniors who are not purely homebound, but they're in assisted living facilities and so on. And, yeah, maybe they can get somebody to get them out of their place and get them to a place where they can get a photo ID, and it'll be free. But, you know, if there are 100-some thousand people in the state who don't have photo IDs, they're obviously not dumping leaves in the Maple Grove leaf dump, and they're not flying on airplanes, but there are 140,000 people out there in the state who don't have them, and basically making it harder, and plenty of people who do have driver's licenses but who don't bring them to the polls with them, and they show up and they wait in line and oops, you can't vote. I guess I think that the story in Indiana a few years ago where the nuns couldn't vote because they didn't have photo ID, we are going to be turning away thousands of people will not be voting because of this. And if there are a handful of people, I don't see the vote fraud you're talking about being a problem. And the people who I think of as being vote fraud, the ones who aren't allowed to vote because they're not eligible because of felony or something else, I don't see how this helps.
Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, I haven't heard about the story of the nuns in Indiana. Could you tell me why they were turned back away from voting?
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I just remember a news story a couple years ago. I think there were like 10 or 12 nuns in northern Indiana who showed up at the polling place. They didn't have photo ID. And they were turned down for not having a photo ID. And I just picture lots of cases in a lot of small towns where people, the election judges know most of the voters even. But, you know, you don't have the photo ID, you turn them down, and, yeah, maybe some of them may have the photo ID at home, and maybe they could go back and do it, but I'll just tell you, you're going to be turning down, I think, tens of thousands of fewer voters because of an attempt to, I think when I've heard this thing being sold, it's as if we'll stop those felons and others who aren't supposed to be voting. And I just see this as having no connection to that.
Yeah. Senator Limmer.
I know we're getting a little off track, but I want Senator Marty to be fully informed. Regarding elderly voters that may be too frail to go out and get a photo, we're not taking away absentee balloting under this provision. They can still do that. We're allowing their health care provider to validate or vouch for them that they can cast a ballot, or at least the administrator of that facility will sign a statement under oath that they actually live at that address. And so we're not doing anything to deny anyone the right to vote. Matter of fact, in the state of Indiana that you had referenced, when they passed a similar bill that's already been upheld by the state and United States Supreme Court, as a result of that policy, or maybe not as a result of the policy, but after this policy went into effect, they had an increase in people voting. I believe by providing a valid voter identification card to those who cannot afford one, it may even encourage people to turn out and vote. Most people, 99 point something percent of our public, actually carries some form of valid photographic identification. So when we really talk of anyone else, it's a very slim window, and we're actually streamlining the method for them to turn up and vote, and they won't be barred or put under any duress at the time of voting. We also require an education program in order to tell the citizens of Minnesota what these changes are and how they can avail themselves of them.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Limmer, I just wanted to commend you on the bill and others that have worked on it with you. It is actually minimal photo identification in many ways to do this. As a person that's been fortunate enough to work in foreign countries, they actually laugh at Minnesota members that we don't require photo identification. The last foreign country I got to work in was Honduras, which requires three different photo identifications so that you can verify, or they figure it's less likely that you've altered the photo identification if you have to have three different ones. In foreign countries, they take it very serious, especially when they're fledgling democracies. And I think we've had that ability to vote for so many years that people take it for granted, and I think that people should take it more serious. And I believe that the articles that we're looking at here in terms of what is proof and what can be used in terms of photo identification is minimal compared to what I see around the world when I do get to be fortunate enough to work in other countries. So I commend you on streamlining this and making it as easy as possible for citizens that don't currently have a photo ID.
Ms. Fraser, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Beth Fraser with the Office of the Secretary of State. And there are a few things I wanted to mention. One is, in partial answer to Senator Marty's question, after every election, we do checks against the Department of Corrections database to identify any felons who may have registered or voted when they should not have. And wanted to let you know that the result of that check in 2010 was that there were 9 felons who voted in the 2010 general election. There were no non-citizens that we identified who voted, although there was one who registered. And anyone who registered or voted illegally was, of course, flagged in the system and turned over to the proper county attorney. I also wanted to note for Senator Limmer that in terms of absentee ballots under this bill, if you don't have a Minnesota driver's license, state ID card, or voter ID card, you would not be able to vote by absentee ballot. That is now a requirement of applying for an absentee ballot. If you don't have one, your absentee ballot would be rejected. Finally, and council said that this was within your committee's purview and is also responsive to Senator Marty's question about being able to catch felons or other non-citizens or others who are ineligible to vote. Section 12 of Article 2, beginning at the bottom of page 29, requires our office to compile a challenged eligibility list, which is a list of people who we believe for some reason are not eligible to vote. We're required to compile that from the Department of Corrections and the courts and Department of Public Safety and other sources. And since we've been doing these checks with the Department of Corrections and the Department of Public Safety, one of the things I've been struck by is The number of false positives. So but both before and after the election, we checked to see if there were any felons or any non-citizens. And on multiple occasions, there were either data entry errors where somebody actually didn't register to vote, and but DPS sent us the information because they thought they had checked the box to register. Or there are people with the same name and the same birth date, one of whom is a felon or one of whom is a citizen and one of whom is not a felon or not a citizen. And we've been able to, because there's a little bit of time before and after the election, to work with DPS to say, you know, are there two people with this name? Is one in Roseau and one in Minneapolis? Is one the felon and one not? And to distinguish this. But what this provision does is it will require election judges in the precinct to make a snap judgment. Oh, it says, you know, Beth Fraser, it says you're a felon. Same birth date, I guess it's you. You'll have to cast a provisional ballot. Then I would have to travel to the county auditor's office at some point in the next 7 days, and if I'm in St. Louis County, that could be up to 200 miles away. So I have to travel there and then prove that I'm not a felon. Well, I don't have a not felon card. I don't know about you guys. I guess you have your get out of jail free cards, but anyway, I don't know how you prove that you're not a felon. So I think that there are actually some fairly large problems with this bill, and I really worry about putting election judges in the position of making these type of determinations on the spot without the ability to double check the accuracy of the information and or whether we're really talking about the person who's standing in front of them.
Senator Limmer?
I'm going to have Mr. McGrath.
Thank you. Mr. Comment. McGrath.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan McGrath. I'm the Executive Director of Minnesota Majority. We've been doing research into Minnesota's election system for the last 3 years. I think I'm going to have to differ with Ms. Fraser on some of the numbers that she's produced here from the Secretary of State's office. Bear in mind that the research that we've done has been based entirely on Data Practices Act requests from the State Department of Corrections, Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, the county auditors, and the Secretary of State's office. Now, as to the snap judgment that Ms. Fraser is suggesting election judges would have to make, the challenge list that's proposed in this legislation would require the Secretary of State's office to produce that list. They are currently producing a challenged voter list for people that are already registered to vote. So I would expect that the non-registered challenged voter list would be equally as accurate as the list that they're currently producing for the roster pages. I wouldn't expect anyone that isn't actually a convicted felon to wind up on that list unless the Secretary of State's office has really dropped the ball on that. Hopefully that won't happen. As to Senator Marty's earlier questioning about numbers, in the 2008 election, Minnesota Majority's research revealed perhaps more than, but an initial match of 2,803 ineligible felon voters participated in that election. Subsequently, because of our research, 100 of them have been convicted and several hundred are being investigated or awaiting trial at this moment. It's taken a long time to get to this point, and I have to point out that it took an outside group to detect this fraud. Prior to that, we were seeing reports that there were a couple of dozen being convicted, and that was the end of the story. So without our work, a lot of these voter fraud cases would never have been caught. That indicates a failure in the system that I think is unacceptable. In addition, we have, with Election Day registration and vouching, an allowance for people to concoct an identity out of whole cloth. I could walk into a polling place with someone else to vouch for me and say my name's Mickey Mouse. And they'll register me to vote, and I'll go on the voter rolls, and they'll give me a ballot. I'll cast it. It gets counted. After the election, they're going to mail me a postal verification postcard. Now, if that postcard comes back as undeliverable because there is no Mickey Mouse, they'll flag me for challenge at the next election. But my ballot's already been counted. After the 2008 election, 38,000 of those postcards were returned as undeliverable mail to the respective county auditors, and 23,000 of them were the result of Election Day registrations. That's about 5% of the 500,000 some odd Election Day registrations from 2008. So there's a significant problem with potential voter fraud. The evidence is there that it exists on a larger scale than what has been revealed in the past. And I think, in addition, this bill does address ineligible voters like felons. It's not simply a voter ID, but there's electronic database used to verify not only your identity, but your eligibility to vote when you show up at the polls.
Thank you. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Limmer, I want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. It's a bill that the vast majority of people in the state of Minnesota want and are looking forward to a couple of Senator Harvey's thoughts. He was concerned about students whether they're going to be able to vote, and I see a provision in here that potential problem is being addressed, whereby they will be able to vote even if their driver's license ID is not showing their current residence. We've addressed the problem of folks being, the elderly not having a current voter ID by allowing their ID to last for the rest of their life. I guess that we've got a provision in here for provisional balloting in the event someone doesn't have a voter ID with them at the time they want to vote. I guess the bottom line is that although we do have a right to vote, there's also comes with that certain responsibilities. And to require somebody to be able to show that they are a citizen and a resident in order to cast their vote, to me, is not a very onerous standard whatsoever. And I think that the people of this state recognize that, and that's why they are requesting that we go forward with this vote.
Senator Limmer, my son Sam is 13, and in his wallet he's got $10, which is probably more than his mom, but he's also got a middle school ID card, picture ID. He's got a Lifetime Fitness card with his photo on it. He's got a Chanhassen Library card in his wallet with his picture on it. And I just think that's where we're heading in this society. I value my vote, and that's what I'm hearing from folks that want this bill to pass, is they value their vote at least as much as a routine financial transaction or checking a book out of the library or putting the lease in the dump. This is important. This is our vote, and it's probably the most important exercise of freedom and self-government that we have. And I really appreciate your work on this, and you as well, Mr. McGrath. It's valuable, and it's worth saying it's valuable and it means something. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know who to direct this question to, but I have to relate something that happened in the last primary election. My father-in-law died 3 years ago, well, actually going on four years ago now, and so when I went to vote and register to vote at the primary election, his name was still on the voter registration form that I signed in, because I signed in right above his name. And I asked the election judge why Harold's name was still on the form, and she said, well, I don't know, you'll have to go to the county auditor's office and figure that out. And, thankfully I live in a small town, and so everybody knew who my father-in-law was. He was actually an election judge. And I just crossed his name out, and my husband and I went and voted. And so when I went to the county attorney's office, I asked that same question. And she said, well, I don't know. And she gave me an answer that I couldn't really make head nor tails of. So I'm wondering, if this would have been a bigger city where nobody knew who Harold Hoffman was, somebody could have come in and said, I'm Harold Hoffman, and could have voted. And there would have been no way to verify that that was him. So there's two things I see there is, why was his name still on the voter registration tally 3 years after his death? And how are we going to prevent that from happening if we don't have a voter ID system, if we're not removing those names in a timely fashion?
Madam Chair, Senator Hoffman, I'd be happy to answer that question. The statute lays out the conditions under which a voter's name can be removed from the rolls because they've died. And it can only be removed if we receive notice from the Department of Health that the person has died, if the county auditor sees an obituary, if they receive written notice from another registered voter in Minnesota that the person has died, or if we are able to match up the information from the Social Security Administration with the voter file to indicate that the person has died. Those are the only circumstances under which a person's name can be removed. And there are certainly instances where people's names are missed through that process. People's names are also removed from the rolls if they don't vote for 4 years. So that's the other way that people who have died, how their names come off the list, is if they don't vote for 4 years.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in a follow-up to that, my father-in-law died in 07. The primary was in 2010. My husband, who was the PR of the estate, notified Social Security immediately. The death certificate was issued immediately. We had many copies made, and we sent them out through the probate process to everybody that we thought needed to have them, but yet his name was still on the voter registration rolls when I went to vote. And again, I live in a very small town, and so we were able to have his name removed, and in the general election it wasn't there. But if had I not seen that and gone and signed a form, 3 years after the fact, he still was on the rolls. And so I have great concerns about those names remaining on the rolls. And without a voter ID in a bigger town that didn't know who Harold Hoffman was, I guess I'm wondering, how do we ever verify that our voter registration rolls are correct?
Other questions or comments regarding Senate File 509? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question to Ms. Fraser would be then, with this scenario, could somebody come out and vouch to say, yes, in fact, this is this person, and could that person then vote?
Ms. Fraser.
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, there are a couple different issues here. One is, just a second. I've lost my train of thought. I apologize. One issue is that in order to impersonate Senator Hoffman's father-in-law, an individual would need to know that he had died and that he was still on the rolls, would need to come in and claim to be him, know his address, and would be taking the risk that the election judges or someone else in line would either know him or them. And so they're taking a fairly big risk that that somebody will know them. Vouching is related to election day registration, and so it's actually a somewhat different process than voting if you're pre-registered.
Ms. Fraser, if Senator Hoffman weren't the fine state senator that she is and had a very strong interest in the election, she could ask a friend to come and she could make sure that person got verified as her father or with that name. I mean, if she were devious, she's not, but if she were, isn't that how that would work? And somebody could vote if Senator Hoffman, knowing full well that her father had passed away and there was a line on the registration list, she could make sure that somebody came in and used that name and voted under that name, correct?
Madam Chair, certainly. If somebody wants to cheat a system, there's a way to do it, and there's ways to do it in this bill as well. And so certainly somebody could come in and claim to be that person and take the risk that they wouldn't be recognized.
Well, and Ms. Fraser, one step more, your office wouldn't know that somebody stepped in and voted under the name of Mr. Hoffman.
Harold
Hoffman. Your office wouldn't know that there was fraud. And so there would have been fraud involved, there would have been cheating involved, and it wouldn't have been caught by your office.
Madam Chair, under this bill, if somebody wanted to, they could make up a fake ID and come in and show it, and nobody would know either.
I think there's a pretty strong distinction there, Ms. Fraser. So, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Fraser, you mentioned about us get out of the jail card free. I'm not sure where that comment came from, but I do know what you're talking about. And frankly, I'd like to see that go away, just a comment being you made it. The other comment I have is, actually, I don't think it's a get-out-of-jail-free card anyhow, but only sheriffs can write those out, I think. The other comment I'd like to make, and Senator Marty was talking about what's broken here. Well, the vouching in itself, voters are able to vouch for as many as 15 people. That whole system there just seems to, to the general public, I don't think we have that issue in our area because everybody knows everybody. But to take somebody around and vouched for them seems to be quite loose. I think it really denigrates the election process. Frankly, if they're taking serious enough about their civic responsibility to vote, at the very least they should do is go out and pre-register and do it in a fashion that you can prove that you are who you are instead of have somebody else vouch for you. That whole concept just bothers me. The other reason I'm so glad this has been brought forward, Senator Limmer, and I applaud you for it, is you know, there's some folks around here, not only in Minnesota but the nation, that are thinking that the voting process is a good process, and we all remember the group Acorn and how that group was accused of. In fact, I think there was 70 some indictments throughout the nation. In fact, just recently they were found guilty of voter fraud, and I think they even had some footprints here in Minnesota. Nothing was ever done about that, or if it was, I wasn't aware of it. In fact, I think we may have requested our own election officials here at the state to do something about it, and nothing ever came of it. So I really applaud your bringing this forward. I think the public is going to be very comfortable with this, and it's the very least we should expect in this process nowadays. And Senator Ortman said it so eloquently, and everybody's got the same thing. We've all got kids and grandkids that carry more IDs in their pockets than probably they even have to. A voter ID is very, very minimal, and I thank you for bringing it forward and also allowing folks to be able to get it for nothing if they can't afford it.
Other questions or comments for Senate File 509? Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, this is going to stop a lot of people from voting. The person in the assisted living facility and so on, Senator Limmer says they can vote absentee without. So in other words, the absentee voters don't need photo ID, I gather. I wasn't aware of that. That's probably a helpful thing, but it makes a question, why do some of us, in effect, if that's the case, if somebody's really out to commit voter fraud, you know, I thought it was like a 5-year felony to do it, and if somebody wanted to pretend they were Senator Huffman's father-in-law and vote, take the risk of getting a 5-year felony, I think if somebody tries to intentionally do that, and I think the handful of cases where people are brought to court on this, most of the ones they investigate are people who inadvertently voted wrong. I mean, they voted in the wrong place, the wrong address, things like that. And if somebody's intentionally trying to do it, you know, if you want to influence an election, a lot cheaper, easier, less criminal ways to influence the election. Mm-hmm. And campaign contributions are an obvious way you can influence a lot more votes than one vote that way. And I guess I'm curious. I have yet to hear somebody who's been fraudulently vouching for numbers of people who aren't supposed to be voting and so on. And I hear a handful of people this, and I still think the bottom line is you're going to be disenfranchising a lot of students, a lot of seniors, a lot of low-income people. And, yes, they can get the card for free if they have access to the time to go to the place to get the card, the photo taken and so on. The bottom line is you're going to disenfranchise tens of thousands of people, and it's not going to do anything about the well, it might if somebody is trying to pretend they're somebody else, but it's not going to do anything for the non-citizen voting, if there are any, and not going to do anything for the felons who are voting. And there are some of those, but this doesn't – driver's licenses don't show that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, we've been writing bills into law for a long time. And I think there's probably not a single law that we've written that someone can't – break the law regarding their own conscious will. So there's always going to be someone that if they want to get into this law and try and figure out a way how to cast a vote, they not only have that opportunity, they might even be successful. But the point is that this bill is going to make it a lot more secure than our archaic, antiquated system that we have now. And quite honestly, I don't think it works anymore, and I think we can do better. And I think we can preserve the sanctity of the voting booth as well as the outcome of elections
by having a more modern system than relying on something that was probably relied on back in the 1920s. And I think we need to go in this new direction. Having said that, I was reminded that Senator Goodwin also had a concern, she can't be here today, regarding the provisional ballot and the felony aspect that we now are creating. And I know that Mr. Turner might have an idea if it has a cost factor to it. I know we had discussion with counsel regarding on page 19 the provisional ballot aspect and how it is grafted into the felony charge of election in general. And I just wanted to broach that subject because in a private discussion, as well as a public reference 2 days ago in another committee, Senator Goodwin thought for some reason that's unconstitutional. I don't believe it is, and I don't think anyone does, but perhaps I could have counsel address that at this time.
Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, I was reading something else, so I didn't get the question.
Senator Limmer, did you say the proposed changes on page 19?
Page 19, lines 5 and 6.
Lines 5 and 6. Ms. Pontius, if you would just look at that and see if there are constitutional issues related to that language, that would be helpful. In the meantime, we'll take Senator Hoffman's comment or question. Senator Hoffman?
Well, I thank you, Madam Chair. I got distracted for a second there. Kind of to what Senator Marty said, and maybe I missed it from Senator Limmer, but when other states have enacted voter ID, does anyone have the result of that, what happens in the next election after voter ID is enacted? Does anyone know what happens in those states?
Mr. McGrath.
Madam Chair, Senator Hoffman, my understanding of the Indiana situation is that they saw an increase in voter turnout comparing like election years. I've heard people argue against the statistics, saying, well, the next year was a presidential election year. But if you compare non-presidential election year to non-presidential election year, you see an increase in voter turnout, and it's likely because of increased voter confidence.
Thank you.
Mr. McGrath. Ms. Pontius, any constitutionality concerns with respect to page 19?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, you're referring to the amendment to the felony?
That's correct.
Statute? I mean, it only applies to a person who intentionally misrepresents identity in requesting a provisional ballot, so I'm not sure what the constitutional issue is there.
I don't know either, and I don't know what Senator Goodwin was trying to bring up. I asked her what it was in committee, and she wouldn't elaborate. But I want to just make sure we had that discussion.
All right. I would encourage maybe Ms. Pontius, you could answer that question for Ms. or Senator Goodwin at some point. Other questions or comments regarding Senate File 509 as amended? Ms. Fraser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for the record, I wanted to clarify a couple of the comments that Mr. McGrath made. One of them has to do with the ineligible voter list. And my concern is not that there will necessarily be inaccurate information on the list, but that there will be confusing information on the list. We looked, for example, and there are two people in Minnesota named Ann Marie Johnson with exactly the same birth date. If one of them was a felon, if the other one went in to vote, their name and birth date would be on this list, and they would probably be prohibited from casting a regular ballot. So it's not that there wouldn't be a person with that name with a felony. The question is it this person? And I think it would be hard for election judges to know. The other issue is the number of postcards that are returned after Election Day. And we provided with Mr. McGrath with the data, and I've tried every which way to figure out how he got the numbers he's gotten, and I can't figure it out. He's reporting numbers higher than our data seem to indicate. But the important part about the postcards is that people register, and you're required to vote at the residence at which you live on Election Day. If you move the day before the election, you need to vote where you've just moved to. If you move the day after the election, you need to vote at the place where you live on Election Day. And so if you move in the weeks or month after the election and they send your postcard to your old address, it will be returned. That doesn't mean that there was a fraudulent vote. And county auditors are required to investigate any returned postcard from an Election Day registrant to see whether the person was eligible. And any that they can't determine the eligibility are turned over to county attorneys. And so even if thousands were returned, that doesn't mean that there were thousands of questionable or ineligible votes. Thank you, Madam
Thank
Chair.
Thank you. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Frazier, there's been a number of times today where you have pointed out what the Secretary of State's office believes is errors in the bill, and I really do appreciate that. But perhaps if I might make a suggestion that the Secretary of State's office maybe offer some solutions or advice as to maybe how to make the voter ID bill better than to simply criticize.
Other questions or comments regarding Senate File 509? Senator Limmer, does this bill have to go to another committee?
Yes, it has to go to the Senate Finance Committee, Madam.
Thank you. Senator Limmer moves that Senate File 509, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee.
Madam Chair.
Senator Newman.
I'd request a roll call vote.
A roll call has been requested. Senator Newman, did you want that in the journal,
please?
We'll pause for just a moment. Senator Newman, Senator Limmer, Senator Hall wanted to vote, and he's been with us all day today, and so just accommodate him for a moment. Hopefully he'll come back in a moment, and we'll take the vote at that point.
Madam Chair.
Senator Jungbauer.
I'll just offer a quick explanation, if I might. Well, I was absent this morning. We had Claims Committee, and Senator Newman and I are both on that, and we needed at least one of us there through the whole process. So we did finish that up, and I got here as quick as I could. So.
Thank you, Senator Jungbauer.
I'm sure while we're waiting, I'll just Senator say that Marty. I don't think this bill will stop a single felon from voting. I don't think the photo ID is going to stop any non-citizens from voting. I think it's going to stop a lot of seniors and young people from voting. And we forget how transient a lot of people are. A lot of people even homeless, and they're getting a photo ID with their address is a pretty tough one. It doesn't mean they don't have a right to vote in this country, and I think we're going to spend a lot of money, and we're not going to eliminate fraud. We're not going to reduce fraud. I think we're going to just turn down a lot of people's ability to vote. And we used to have it where it was very hard to vote in this country. You had to own land. You had to be male. You had to be white. We slowly loosened it up and decided this was a democracy for everyone. But in the end, this is going to make it harder for a lot of seniors to vote, a lot of young people to vote. And that may not be the intent, but that's the consequence of it. And for the handful of people who are pretending to be somebody else, maybe it'll stop one of those every election cycle, but it'll stop tens of thousands of real voters who should be voting.
Senator Jungbauer.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and maybe Senator Limmer could answer this, but, you know, as I listen to Senator Marty and we hear of perhaps a handful of people across the country, how many states, Senator Limmer, have photo ID now currently?
Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, I believe it's 8 that have that. And then others have a very robust identification system or requirement. If they don't have a photo identification, they do require some type of voter identity to be validated before they cast a ballot.
And
thank you, Senator Jungbauer.
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, in terms of Supreme Court decisions and things, I think I've read a few that have outlined that the Supreme Court didn't seem to find any problem with disenfranchising voters, and we have enough court challenges that you've fashioned this around those court challenges to be sure we're identifying any potential problems?
Madam Chair, this bill is modeled after the Indiana law, and the Indiana law sustained constitutional question in not only the state of Indiana but in the United States Supreme Court. The Georgia law was just recently upheld as well. This bill, I cannot say, is specifically designed around the the Georgia law, but case after case, it appears as though the courts do not find any illegitimacy or any unconstitutionality in the proposal.
And to the Senator Marty's point, in my view, Senator Marty, this bill doesn't take anything. It restores integrity, and it restores public confidence. And maybe you don't see that there have been enough instances of fraud, but I know enough folks in my district and around the state that are very troubled with election integrity, and what we're trying to do here is restore faith that people who are voting really are eligible to vote and that they only vote one time. Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my final question is, Senator Limmer. Senator Limmer, you've been around here much, much longer than I have. Have you ever found any laws or legislation that we've worked on around here to be perfect and not, you know, potentially have a few outliers that get affected by it?
Well, there's quite a few laws in the last 38 years that I could probably question, but nevertheless, Senator, I think one can make a valid question of just about anything if you wanted to dig far enough. But on the same token, the way our elections or our legislative system works, we work with the best knowledge we have, and we try to be extremely careful of the constitutional rights that are given to all of our citizens. And I believe we've done that in this bill.
Senator Murray.
Madam Chair, I was just speaking while we were waiting for Senator Hall, but since it started something new, I would like to – I would not disagree with Senator Jungbauer. I don't have any doubts that the Supreme Court would uphold this as constitutional. I do think a lot of your constituents, Senator Ortman, who think they have concerns about who's voting fraudulently in the election, think it's felons who are voting fraudulently, and this won't touch that. A lot of these things won't touch – the photo ID doesn't accomplish it. And it does accomplish blocking a lot of other people, like those nuns in Indiana. There's plenty of people like that here. 140,000, I think I heard, in Minnesotans who don't have photo ID. And frankly, a lot of them will get it because of this, but there will be tens of thousands who don't vote because of it. And it's not all people who don't have it now, but it's people who don't have a current one right now, the people who are moving the month before. And there are lots of people who move twice a year, young people particularly. And this will disenfranchise them, period, and it's not going to do anything to stop felons from voting, period.
Would this be an appropriate Senator, time, Madam Chair, to call the question?
Senator Newman has renewed his motion. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you. I'd like to address some of the periods John's talking about over there. Senator Marty, thank you, Madam Chair. I think you're underestimating the senior citizen in our state. I think they're very engaged. I think they're they're a voting bloc that I think both parties can count on to get to the election process, to the election booth. And frankly, that's the most of the complaints I'm getting it from is senior citizens, and they want this cleaned up. They want it cleaned up. So I don't think they're going to be disenfranchised. In fact, I think they're going to probably going to encourage more people to come out and vote because it's getting closer and closer to being in their minds. A lot more valid if it's in this fashion. So
thank you. Senator Newman renews his motion, or Senator Limmer renews his motion that Senate File 509 be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee.
As amended.
And Senator Newman has requested a roll call, which has been granted. The vote will be recorded in the journal. Any questions about what we're voting on now? All right, the clerk will take the roll.
Senator Thompson.
Yes.
Senator Hall?
Yes.
Senator Goodwin? Senator Marty?
No.
Senator Jungbauer?
Yes.
Senator Latz? Senator Newman?
Yes.
Senator Ortman?
Yes.
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Yes.
Senator Hoffman?
Yes.
Senator Scheid? Senator Harrington? Senator Limmer?
Yes.
There being 8 ayes and 1 no, Senate File 509 is recommended to pass. Senator Limmer, is there further business before the committee?
There is no further business before the committee. I move for adjournment.
We are adjourned.